This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Shane Bugby. He's an artist and filmmaker. Shane Bugby, great speaking with you.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, great speaking with you.
And I'm also joined here with Francis Nelly, slash Pillator.
Hello, Robert. Hi, Shane. Nice to see you both again.
To start things off, Shane, can you give us some background information about you and some of the media coverage from a while back? I mean, you do have a somewhat extensive Wikipedia page.
Oh, yeah, I wish that Wikipedia page were correct anymore. It was vandalized.
Oh, yeah, it's always like that.
Crazy talk. Oh, anyway, yeah, I wish that's a whole... Anyway, it's hard to talk about myself a lot of times. But I suppose some of the bigger media... Before the internet, I was able to get viral, let's say, and viral back then was like being in every newspaper in the world, and that was really cool. So I've been in every newspaper in the world back in the day.
I think it was the Zero Zeros.
Oh, Jesus, probably the 90s, even late 90s. But yeah, something like that. You know, when was the Mike Diana trial? I think it was the late 90s, I would say. Late 90s, right before 2000. But that viral... That hit, I was able to sustain that kind of momentum for at least a decade, you know, because I kept hitting things like Columbine, Trenchcoat Diaries, Dana Plato's death. And these are Columbine Massacre. I got stuff from some of the Trenchcoat Mafia and that hit viral. Dana Plato was a TV star that died on the phone with me, and I had it on record. And so I would say, so the bigger media was like Spin Magazine or Extra. There's these broadcast TV. Again, this is pre-internet, so it was a big deal. There's only three channels. So it was like NBC had a show called, I think, Extra. And they had
come I remember. To, yeah, I remember that show.
Right on. So they came out to cover me, and I was in the National Enquirer and all that. And those people pay. So it was after this superstar, this TV star's death, they were like outside my home looking through my garbage. And I like made Extra bring like 10 grand in cash. And then they brought a check, and I'm like, yeah, you can't film. And they're like, no one pays cash. And I'm like, you're going to have to find cash. I don't trust you. And so they bring like 10 grand in cash. And that was the biggest moment, I would say, just because it was such huge outlets.
And you're associated with Satanism. Do you identify as a Satanist?
It depends on who I'm talking to. I'm more of an agnostic in the Carl Sagan sense of the word, where it's like, I don't know really what's, I don't think any, I know most do not, none of us know what's going on. I know this.
Because you get kind of pigeonholed as a promoter of Satanism, but you're saying that's not really accurate.
If you're a Christian and you want to go there, I'm fine with it. But I look at Satanism as an art movement. And you know, I was a friend with Anton LaVey, and I published a book called Might Is Right, and he wrote the foreword for it. And so he made me the last priest. I'm the last person in the old guard of the Church of Satan. And so I think that's cool. As a metalhead that started my business living in a Chevette, that's like, it was an Academy Award to me. I was like, this is the greatest thing. Anton LaVey recognized me, and I got to go hang out at his house. So it was a real cool thing, but... I don't take it as seriously as a lot of people do.
There's like so many different interpretations, both like there's Satanists who embrace like the Christian version of Satanism, or there's people who embrace it like they have their own theological take, of Satan is more like a rebel, and then there, a lot of them are pretty agnostic or atheist, but they just treat it as more in a symbolic sense. So there's so many different like interpretations of that.
Yeah, I think it goes back to LaVey all the time, though. Throughout my history, I've seen people try to riff off of Satanism, and it usually always comes back to Anton, and for good reason. I was talking to someone else about this. He did something that pulled him. He didn't try to recreate anything. He was a huckster and an artist, but there was something inside him that pulled him along, and it was really an original thing. I mean, look at how he was dressing, almost in stage gear, in real. But he made it look so great and so sexy, and everything he did was perfect. It seemed just his whole presentation, and when people try to riff off that, it just doesn't work. It goes back to him, and which I think is cool, you know. I think it is, you know, culture vultures, you know, die horrible deaths like that. They look like fools usually, and not the good kind of fool.
Why do you think Satanism is associated more like with the left and or liberal?
Well, that would be like a Christian thing. I think it is. Satanism, you know, I wonder where you see that as more, because within an artist community or people who are in the know, I don't think amongst the cultists, they must know, at least the old people I know understand it's a both. Like Satanism doesn't stick to anything. It's a really an individual kind of thought. So it's like one of the greater quotes LaVey came up with is like, you can't nail Satanism to the wall. You can't nail Satanists to the wall. And I think that's the truest thing. It's really a balanced kind of thing. There's within Satanism, you meet people who are on both sides. At least the conversations are very intellectual. The old day, like it's just a different thing when it was underground. It was counterculture still when I was part of it. It was not like it is today. And, you know, when I helped start the Satanic Temple, that really took it to a different direction, and not one that I'm happy about. But.
Do you think there's parallels between Satanism and the dissident right?
Yeah, I don't see it that way. Unless you're saying it just period dissident, you know, but I don't see it as a right or left thing. I do see it as an act of rebellion, but almost not anymore. It's close to being very accepted, and
it's so embraced by like pop culture. Like you have all these like the rapper Lil Nas uses satanic symbolism, and then that's kind of like bait for social conservatives to get outraged. And it is like become like a cliche, like Hollywood using satanic imagery.
Yeah, I wonder if that's all, but that's always seems to be has been the case. I know Jinx. There's a woman called, her name's Jinx, and she fronts the band Coven. And I had conversations with her, and she's like, you know, Alice Cooper never believed in Satanism. Black Sabbath doesn't believe in that stuff. They use it for shock. They use it to get headlines and stay in the headlines. And, you know, you'll hear Ozzy Osbourne talk about being a Christian, which is disappointing to me. So I don't know if it's anything's changed. What's changed is seeing people of color embrace it. Cholo goth, stuff like that. It was not like that when I was younger.
Oh, what is avant-garde hate?
Oh, boy. You know, avant-garde hate. Now, I took some notes on your questions. Let me see here. Avant-garde hate. Voting. I was like politicizing for Trump or liking Kanye because of his views on Jewish folks running the entertainment industry. I think that's like avant-garde hate. I don't think it's anything but that. Like it's weird to see people jump on these bandwagons just to be anti-rebellious. But I remember doing that with Pat Buchanan when I was younger too, though. Pat Buchanan was like, and that's why I referenced Trump. I'm not against or for him, but Pat Buchanan was running for president. He was so out there, so right wing. People were
this was a, 2000, I think the in 2000.
Right on. He was like called a Klansman and all this stuff. And I was like, I put his vote for Pat Buchanan in my window in my house just to irritate people. And it was just that avant-garde hate, I suppose you would call it. You guys are creating a whole new language, though, and it's interesting. I know virtue ethics is something I've heard, and it was like, that's the same word, it seems like, virtue ethics. But
Virtue's ethics is like a platonic thing. It's just that's being used as a buzzword in the right wing circles, you know, and they're racing back to Plato. But for avant-garde hate, I wrote an article on that because just like what Bugbee is saying, there seems to be an association with the political right that I'm only quote unquote right wing because the establishment is what we perceive as liberal.
Like radical contrarianism.
Right. And you're kind of being transgressive. And it's unfortunate that today what was once the establishment, you know, that traditional Christian 1950s ideal, now is supposedly becoming a quote-unquote counterculture. But then we have to question whether really is that a counterculture or there's this avant-garde hate aspect as whatever you're for, I'm against, right. And this can go on many levels. And so I think avant-garde hate is I just want you to feel I want to be a hater because it's the intention of it. It's like being into power electronics music and White House and all that, I would say, is avant-garde hate.
And I guess, Francis, you have this concept of ethical sadism. Do you want to explain that, and then I can get, then we can get like Shane's thoughts on that?
I also wrote about ethical sadism, and I think it has to do in a weird way as a continuation of avant-garde hate, where if in avant-garde hate you are celebrating Philip Best of, you know, White House, his, you know, publishing label, something Sulfate, but anyway, you know, all that Peter Soto stuff, it seems to me that it just wants to be transgressive, but there's no context to it. It's just feeling hate. And so my option against that, or at least solution, was to be an ethical sadist, which sounds like a conundrum. I mean, sadist, you must mean you get pleasure from pain. But an ethical sadist would be, I'm deriving my pleasure from a pain that is ethical. So, of course, you want to see bad people get what they deserve. Hence, you enjoy that. And there's some level of ethical sadism there, from whatever you want to say, chaos magic, to pranking the opponent because you feel it's just. I think this is like the true intention of what it means to be, say, Antifa, rather than that you're for a liberal state as opposition to fascism. So I think ethical sadism, what I'm contemplating, has early intentions of what I was thinking the Church of Satan was for. But I would like to hear Bugbee on that.
Oh, that's funny you said that. And I wrote my answers. I took at some of these questions and wrote my answers down. And I said, maybe ethical Satanism is sadism is justice. And as a Satanist, that's definitely one of the foundations I hate to say Levian Satanism because it's just like Satanism to me, but Levian Satanism is justice. And so I think like I had a friend I was starting to work with, and I experienced this kind sadism where he was using nonviolent communication. He was using very kind words, but he understood he was triggering me. I was getting upset or angry, and I could see the joy in his eyes. And he played it off like we were debating or having these conversations of intellectual conversations, but it wasn't. He was like this kind sadism. He was this kind person, but he was getting off on, you know, my homicidal rage. And so, yeah, so that's how I see it. I guess the polite person were cruelty in their mind. So it's very similar to what.
Or what about putting like your dark fantasies into creative endeavors or the arts? Does that count?
Well, I don't know. I don't consider my fantasies dark. See, I just consider my fantasies. Other people are the ones that are going to call it dark because they come from a different perspective. My perspective, it's just my fantasies. So, you know, that's I don't really see things in dark and light in that respect. You know, especially amongst fantasies, they just are, and they're so complex and they're rooted in, like, your younger childhood. They're rooted in other wild places. And so I just
your subconscious especially.
Yeah, I don't see them as dark. I just see them as part of the person's character, especially if they're able to let them out, especially if they're able to exercise their demons, let's say, if we're talking satanic stuff. But, like, yeah, especially if they're able to practice them. If you've ever been to a sex club or a bondage club or anything like that, it gets wild. And it's cool to see people let themselves go. It's sad to see them needing a club to do it or a private location to get together, and they can't explore that with their neighbors, let's say.
Do you have a lot of interest in Crowley and like chaos magic and the occult?
I, Yes. I don't know what a lot is. I don't really. I love studies, any kind of mystic, you could say esoterica. So I do, but I'm not a fan of any necessarily one person. I was friends with LaVey, and so I was jumped into the counterculture before LaVey came around for me. I was jumped in by White Panthers and people that I was working with in Chicago at the Underground Comics Hall of Fame. So, and White Panthers are a branch of the Black Panthers. And so I was part of the counterculture then. So I see LaVey as part of the counterculture. I was just part of a counterculture, met LaVey, and he was part of a counterculture. So it was like we worked together. So I appreciate Crowley and his influence. I mean, it's amazing when any person can have the influence like LaVey or Crowley. Crowley had such an immense influence. You see it all around today, but no one knows it came from him. And that's really wild. That's just just as an artist, that's everything. That's, I think, what you want more than to be remembered in a museum. You want to change the world. You want to push the pendulum in your direction, the way you want things to go, and you can. And these people show it, and they usually die broke, ostracized, all this kind of stuff. But they change the world, or they change minds, and it just keeps parlaying into more and more. I mean, I think of David Bowie when you talk about Crowley, like, and how popular he was, and still is, and he's a total devotee to Crowley. And so it's like he had, and Bowie had such influence on so many people as an artist, and he's a great artist. And so that's just amazing to me, is the influence of a great artist. And I think Crowley or LaVey had that artistic mind. And I love Chaos Magic. If you think about, I think of the transgressive art movement, something I was part of, and I don't know if I still am, but I don't know if that even exists anymore, transgression, but I think that is the modern Chaos Magic, let's say, as you could see it practiced in the transgressive art movement.
I actually would even identify as a theosophist, but you were telling me you have interest in Blavatsky as well.
Oh, and if you ever get to Chicago, the main Theosophical Center is in Chicago, and they have Blavatsky. How do you say the name?
Blavatsky, there's
Blavatsky. I want to say it correctly, Blavatsky.
I think there's in LA there, I've been there, but there's a place called I don't know if it's Theosophical Society or Philosophical Society, but there's a place in LA. It's like a speaking venue, and then also they have a bookstore, The Occult, okay. Which is kind of, I think it's like Las Vegas.
The Chicago, the one in the western suburbs of Chicago is an official, the United States hub for the Theosophical Society, and they have Blavatsky's, and I'm mangling the pronunciation, but that's what I do. They have personal effects from her, and so it's really wild to go there. And I, you know, I've touched her teacup, and I love stuff like that. And so, yeah, I have an interest in it. Those are the dreamers. They're like Steve Jobs. Let's say he's a modern. I look at him like a modern occultist. So those are the people who imagine a new world. And so you fucking right. I have an I appreciate people that have a great imagination. Yeah. I have an impeccable imagination. So I hone that by hanging out at places like the Theosophical Center and checking out some of their rare books.
You're also an expert on serial killers, going back to the true crime stuff you mentioned at the beginning of the show. You've also corresponded with serial killers in prison. Talk about that, and which serial killers have you corresponded with?
Oh, well, I worked with Gacy on the book Question of Doubt. And this is where I was sort of pulled into that. I was working at the Underground Comic Hall of Fame in Chicago, the Bucktown Pub. And the owner there was starting to buy and sell Gacy paintings. And he had this rapport with Gacy's nephew. And so I started selling him, and made a ton of money that year. Right before Gacy's death. And we did a 900 number, 900 call John or call Gacy. So we did a 900 number with him. We did all these stunts. And so, and I met Gacy's nephew, and it was really scary because he had a young man with him that was the exact replica of all of Gacy's victims. And they all looked the same, this young metalhead, brown hair.
I think in Netflix Dahmer, I think you said you saw that. I think actually the Gacy scene towards the end is one of the most disturbing scenes of the series.
Yeah, Gacy. Yeah, I rode my bike up to Gacy's home when they were pulling out. I was a little kid, and I rode my bike up there. And that's really what got me into like serial killer study, because I was hearing things from like the cops and the people that were digging it up, and they were talking about dildos, bloody dildos, and stuff like that. And then you go home and to read the newspaper, and there was nothing like that mentioned. So I was like, hey, the reporters were standing right next to me. That's why I ran home to buy all these newspapers. I'm like, wow, I met that reporter. It was like I met a famous person, and they were asking all these questions and getting all these answers, but it didn't show up in the newspaper. And I felt like the newspaper clippings were like erotic almost. It was like it took out the horror and made it almost sexy. And so that's how I saw the Gacy thing. The favorite serial killer I worked with was Richard Ramirez. And I liked Richard because he was honest. Brutally honest. He talked about liking what he did and how he would do it again if he were released. And I appreciated that, just like Panzeram. Panzeram was very honest about his love of his sadistic love of torturing and killing people. And most serial killers, most people in prison are like, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. No matter you have a photo or not, they're like, I didn't do it. And so I appreciated Richard Ramirez for that reason. Also because he would have you send, like, he's like, was very specific. If you wanted to hang out with Richard on the phone or anything, you had to send him Asian porn, but with feet, foot porn. He liked Asian feet. And I was like, okay, deal. And I did a cookbook with Dorothea Puente. You know, I loved working with Thea, but, you know, we almost had she had a love affair with me. So it was really great. I loved it.
You were also one of the first people to get the police photos of Dahmer.
Oh yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, just because you become especially pre-internet, you just become a hub. I was a hub for that stuff. So it was like Chris Farley, when he passed away, people sent me the photos. But yeah, the Dahmer stuff's just someone up in Milwaukee. He's like, I know this guy who deals with serial killers, and sent me like photocopies of that. And
I just started. The journalist?
What was that?
The journalist or the cops did?
Oh, journalist. You're right. Yeah, exactly. A journalist that had done interviews with me had sent me, you know, I knew you'd like this, Shane. And so I started selling them on eBay. And the same with, like, I got a Michael Jackson police report from a tattoo artist that bought a bunch of Gacy paintings from me and was selling them to someone in L.A. And they traded him this police report. And he wanted to make that part of a deal for a Gacy painting. He's like, I'll give you the Michael Jackson police report. And that was that was substantial, because I put it up on eBay, and eBay lawyers called and said, you know, the victim in this police report isn't getting paid because of this on eBay, and we're asking you to take it down, because otherwise, if we have to sue you or something like that, we have to do something. And this was before they had pull down things that they do now. They automatically pull things. And so they asked me to take it down because they didn't want it to be public. But that police report was brutal. The Michael Jackson one was, out of everything I've ever received, that was the worst. It was like, oof.
I think, like, the Netflix Dahmer, it was really well done. And, like, I mean, yeah, there's some, like, woke stuff in there, but I didn't mind it because it was almost, like, it was so over the top, it came across as satirical. But overall, I thought it was really well done. But I think what was kind of disturbing about it is that it tricks the audience into empathizing with him, because what's remarkable is that they make him come across as extremely likable. And you end up empathizing him, which is pretty, I mean, which is kind of like, considering like what he did is actually kind of disturbing.
I love that. Okay. I have not watched a serial killer anything in maybe over a decade. They just became too cliche or too boring, or they just didn't tell the truth. The last thing I watched, I guess, was the BTK killer one on CBS, I think it was.
Oh, right.
And it was like, I'm watching it, and I knew that I had the police reports, I knew the facts, and they made like this one scene. He's like sharing a cigarette with the victim before she dies. And he shares the cigarette with her. She takes a puff. And then they cut to a commercial of vanilla ice cream, like literally vanilla ice cream. And it blows my mind, because in the reality of that situation is he's smoking the cigarette and putting it out on her face, burning her with it as he's doing his deal. And so I'm like, that just always bothered me, that the reality of the stuff wasn't presented. And I thought Dahmer was real. It was realistic. I thought they showed a realistic side of him. And I thought that was cool. You know, I thought the Dahmer, did you like it?
I think it was excellent.
Yeah, I did too. I really liked it because they tried.
I think it is pretty, like, from what I've heard, it is pretty, like, fairly accurate to the story. Like, even, like, even like some of the victims were saying, like the court scene was extremely accurate. And almost like, ooh. Well, some of them were. I mean, some of the victims were offended. They felt that they were exploiting their tragedy, but at the same time, they did like acknowledge that it felt like almost an exact recreation.
They feel that way until they get paid. Okay, and that's always that's like a lawyer talk almost.
Yeah.
But I got a story about that. Okay, Dahmer. So check this out. One of his victims got picked up in Chicago, and it was in Boys Town, and I believe Boys Town in Chicago is the first nationally designated gay area, believe it or not, in Chicago. So I used to living in my car. I was a friend with someone there. He had a store called the 99th Floor. Mickey Thompson, I believe his last name was, but his brother was. In Silence of the Lambs, he was the person who dug the hole. I forget what his name is now. And he put his dick between his legs, and his brother was in the movie. Okay. As his brother's that actor, and his brother was staying with him while he was studying for this part. And he's looking out the window and he sees Dahmer pick up the victim that ends up missing. Well, they only understood it as there's a person that lived in the neighborhood that became missing, and that was a tight-knit community. And so when someone was missing, they put flyers up, and they were really upset about things. And his brother was there as a witness, you know, telling the cops, like, I saw this person get into a car with basically Dahmer, which was, you know, and then it becomes, you know, he stars in this, you know, and he's studying for the movie while he's seeing this. So it was just, I don't know. That's always a wild story to me. Ironic.
What do you think about some of the later interviews with Dahmer?
I like all of the Dahmer interviews. He's a real creepy dude, you know? Why do you mean the later ones? The ones where he was trying to express himself?
I forget what it was, Entertainment or CBS, I forget. But he basically took full responsibility for his actions.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. He was and Gacy did something similar to that at the end. Like,
then interesting in the series, like, so his baptism was the exact same day as Gacy's execution, and there was like a solar eclipse.
I know. I talked to Helen Morris, and she has Gacy's brain in her basement, and she's supposed to be studying it for some reason. I don't know if you can, but I suppose you can. I don't know why you'd keep a brain in your basement, but Helen Morrison has Gacy's brain, and Gacy gave that up for study. Oh, I guess. Ted, what the hell's his name? Ted Bundy did his last interview is great. When you talk about last interviews, so and them coming clean on their crimes, that's another great one. But yeah, I love all that. I loved all that stuff back then because it wasn't what it is today, you know. And not that I have nostalgia for it, but it just anything that comes from a counterculture. When I was doing True Crime Warp Mind, I did it. We did a tour, and I did like Gacy. I had Ed Gein's tombstone with me at some point, and went to Salem, Massachusetts, and the mayor boycotted. It was not above ground yet. It was still counterculture. It was still a really taboo thing to talk about.
What are your thoughts on like the whole current true crime scene that's become extremely popular and widespread?
My thoughts on a lot of that stuff that I was involved with is like, how did I not get that money? Like I was doing it, and we were doing it and doing it better. So it's like, that's what my thoughts are on it. It's like, but I never looked to market that stuff. I did an interview with the state's attorney of Illinois that put Gacy to death. And he's like, you know, he was the first person to say, Shane, you're a journalist. You're doing the same thing as other journalists are doing. You just don't.
Is it you're saying you interviewed the prosecutor?
Yeah. Oh yeah. He gave me the Gacy photo you see of him in the pogo gear. He gave me the original one right off of Gacy's bar. He's like, this is the original one. This is the one you see duplicated all the time. And it was great because I meet with him and he's like, Shane, I've got something for you. I met with Gacy's lawyer. I got to play with Gacy's wallet, that had the receipt in it. And I open it up and the receipt that put him in prison is in there. And I'm like, holy shit, dude. And then I put on Gacy's jacket, the jacket you see him being arrested in, and it fits. And the guy's like, you know, you could play Gacy in the TV show. And that's where I think I caught depression for the rest of my life because I was like, I really got to lose some weight. I got to do something here. I didn't want to look like, you know, it was a weird thing to be called. I look like Gacy, but from his lawyer, maybe he's harassing me. But, oh, yeah, I got to see Gacy's masturbation box. He had this little box that he had in jail, the county jail, with baby oil wrapped in it and a, a paperback of gay erotica. And so it was like, I got to go through all the Gacy stuff. But yeah, the state's attorney gave me a big folder and had like a bunch of stuff from Gacy's desk at his home, his insurance policies, and the clown photo. And so, you know, yeah, when I was doing that stuff, I was hooked in, and people came to me with everything. You know, it was just a magnet for it.
I remember when I got into the interesting serial killer stuff, it was more through Dennis Cooper. And I remember he had a couple of short stories on it. He had fictional accounts of it, but he, in his short story, A Jerk, he was really interested in the Houston mass murders. I think that was Dean Kroll. But that particular case is really interesting because he had two teenagers help him do the killings while they did other erotica too. So there is this association with like hedonism and having fun, and then like the typical slasher film, everyone dies or something. And it sounds so fake, but this is real. And so you could see why Cooper was into that. So do you know much of the Houston mass murders?
I do know about those. I know about, and there's all, yeah, I do. And I think a lot of that stuff, you know, comes from like repression. Like I think that comes from a Christian society. A religious society that frowns on human sexuality. You know, there's nothing more natural than human sexuality, and to have it been, to have people that are whatever they like ostracized or picked on or beaten up on, or is to me the foundation of serial killers. Let's say, I don't think a lot of them are, I don't think there's a, whatever people look for the gene. Do serial killers have this magic gene, this, you know, or chromosome or whatever they would talk about? And I don't think it's anything like that. I think it's just a byproduct of our society, and we're unwilling to change our society for what, I don't know why, but Otis Toole's the only person that I can think of that I saw was like, yeah, Otis Toole's a killing machine because he just is out of his mind. And I don't want to disparage anyone who's out of their mind. I'm out of my mind often. I'm on meds. But Otis Toole had some genetic problems. I think so. I'm, of course, not a doctor or anything, but I think he was somewhere messed up beyond, you know, there was no, I think he was born that way. Okay, I think Otis Toole's like one person that was born a serial killer. The rest were, you know, created out of like repression. You know, there's some cases that are desperation, you know, desperate, like Eileen Wuornos. But even her, she was, you know, had to have a lot of trauma.
Do you think that also applies to like the new wave of like these mass shooters?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I think so. Mass shooters. Okay, so it went from in my generation, it was suicides. You'd have someone in high school would kill themselves, and then you'd have three more people in the high school kill themselves throughout that week, and then the next high school over would have a plague, and then would just like domino effect. Kids would start killing themselves, and so like that grew into school shooting, field form, because again they had to be bullied or victimized at some point, and they're acting out. And so, yeah, the mass shooter is like an evolution of the serial killer for sure. But I think there is this, like, what do you call people who don't have sex a lot? You guys have a word for this?
Incels.
Incels. I think, yeah, they're like, there's incels. It's like a forced repression, or they don't, and I don't know if they know how to communicate their sexuality, even incels. I don't know if they have and I don't know what happened to them. I don't know if that's a religious thing or not.
And they have like their own subculture with like their own terminology and like dark humor that they use.
Yeah, I see some of that. Again, it, like every generation creates their own language, and it's basically the same stuff that we were talking about, I don't understand what's going on because there's a different language being spoke every generation. So I'm starting to, as the older I get, the further away I'm like, what are you talking about, kids? You know, so I sort of lose it. But I catch some of that with the incel jokes. They have a different language anyway. I'm actually a little nervous talking to you guys. So this is a very unusual thing for me. I'm usually never nervous doing interviews.
You mean the subject matter?
No, it's the two of you. What I read on your Twitter feed, you're very smart. I want to say young men. I don't know your age, but you're very smart. And like I said, you speak a different language. And so it's intimidating. A little bit. So enjoy. I don't often have this feeling when I do interviews. So I'm sort of stuttery talking to you. So you're very smart people.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. And I really appreciate what you post, but I can't figure out where you're at, which I love. I'm like, I don't know. Are they left? Are they right? What's going on here with these guys? And why are they being blocked by Lex Friedman?
Lex Friedman. He seems to block like everyone. Like I think
I'm everyone.
He has...
I'm everyone. Why am I not blocked? I'm that old. I'm like, forgotten.
I don't know what's going on, but some people say he created like this bot where he uses an algorithm that selectively blocks people who use certain like buzzwords or associate with other people. That's what I've heard, but who knows?
That's weird. That is so weird. But I just, so I wonder where you guys are coming from, you know, and which is wonderful because they, you know, when you get to a certain age, there's not a lot of wonder starts.
And the mystery is good. Like, I don't feel like giving you like some label or good. Some short sentence to describe myself.
Well, it keeps me engaged. It keeps me reading and stuff. And that's the same with, and I know you as Francis, I know you as Pill Eater. And so this is how I know you.
And yes.
So I love the stuff you post on Twitter. Often I love it. It's challenging. And so, you know, I'm glad you want to keep the mystery because it keeps me engaged, but yeah, there you go.
And you know, it's interesting because like, I've interviewed Jim Goad like, a couple of times
I'm sorry to hear that.
And you said you interacted with him back. Was this back in the 90s?
I forget what year it was. We did the Angry at Malteor, and I was friends with Goad when he put out his first Answer Me. I was one of the first people in Chicago to buy it and say, hey, let me help you distribute it. So I knew Goad and Debbie. I knew the Goads for a long time, and the Goads came to the Expo the Extreme that was the event I did in Chicago, where I brought black metal into the United States for the first time. And it was the weekend that Anton LaVey died, so it was really wild. But Boyd Rice was there, and the Goads were there. And so I was friends with Jim for a moment, and now we're not. I don't like Goad at all.
So with Jim Goad, I've interviewed him before, but did you have any, was there any like ideological disagreements with him?
You know, we did this Angry White Male tour, and I don't know if I ever understood his political ideology back then. I think back then we were just artists, you know, what did I write down here for you? Pre-internet folks clinging to that dead world. Okay, go. Okay.
He writes political articles on Countercurrents now, and prior to that, he was on Tacky Mag. But I think like Answer Me was more like I saw it more as art. It wasn't overtly political.
Right. When we're part of this art aesthetic terrorism movement or art that kills movement, that at least there's a book out with that and goes in there. And I didn't see any of us as right wing. So it recently I've done like an interview or two, and people like, I'm surprised you're left wing, Shane. And I was like, I've always been that. Just because I maybe platformed a Nazi here or there, it did not mean I was a Nazi. But now today, that is something interpreted differently. Platform a Nazi, you are a Nazi, not a journalist. So it's like, you know, it's just,
or just talk. Yeah. Like just talking to someone, it's like the total guilt by association culture.
Right. And I think Goad, I wonder if he just didn't go along with what was popular, because it was like that was what was popular. But back in the day, he was being embraced by like left-wing comedians and stuff like that.
Didn't he? I think, Francis, you said he used to be friends with Margaret Cho.
Yeah.
Right.
He was on Bill Maher. I believe he's on Bill Maher. So he was like, we were all embraced by this left-wing thing. And I that's what I'm about, I guess. I don't know where I'm at really. I can't be stuck to the wall, but I think he just embraced something that was embracing him, to be honest with you. I don't remember him being.
There's been all these weird, bizarre paradigm shifts because like you did have a kind of like avant-garde, more like pro free speech left that was a reaction against like the Reaganite kind of social conservatism in the 80s and 90s. And now, like, what's considered left-wing is very, like, anti-freedom of expression and free speech. So there's been, like, all these weird, like, paradigm shifts about, like, what these labels mean, and it gets very convoluted.
Yeah, is Goad racial now? Is he a racial person now? I don't know. Yeah. Is he?
He's full-on white nationalist right now.
Oh, okay, here we go. Then Angry at Meltor. It was funny, his big thing with me, well, Shane, have you ever have you ever had a black hooker in a hotel room like me? I, this is my thing. And then we're on this tour and we end up at a pancake house or something, you know, on the road. And he's like, I'm traveling with this woman here. And she was like a 300-pound black woman. And he was with her. Like, that was his date for a few of the shows. And I'm nothing wrong with that. But when you talk about this right-wing ideology, I'm like, is that part of the deal? You know? And so, and on that angle,
I'll add a counterbalance. Like, my political philosophy is really like dualism. So I would actually say, like, as a dualist, I'd say embrace the contradictory as your politics. That's what I would say.
Well, I like that myself. I'm a contrarian all the way, but I just wonder how that sits with Goad today.
I got to interview Adam Parfria about a few years before he died. And I know Feral House, they published Anton LaVey. Did you ever have any connection to Parfria or Feral House?
Oh yeah. Parfria would turn red and start spittling and go crazy if you mentioned my name to him, cause I made him pay me. He was so angry about this. He was so pompous. Like, and Goad's like, why are you doing this to Adam? But Adam was putting out this book with the serial killer, Danny, I forget his name, from Florida, a serial killer from Florida. And I had already had the contract signed. And so he was starting to publish it. And I talked to a lawyer and they're like, listen, we'll do this and I'll have to destroy the books once they're printed. So I went to Adam and told him that. And he's like, well, I'll give you the money I'll give you the $200. I'm like, no, dude, now it's $2,000. And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, you're going to pay me $2,000 now because you weren't nice to me about it. Had you asked me and been cool, I probably would have let you do it without it. It would have been an honor at that point to work with him, you know, or because he was this counterculture elder. But he just stepped on my toes in a way where I was like, yeah, fuck you, you're paying me. And so I know someone went to do a documentary about something or other, Satanism or something, and they asked about me. And he's like, that little fucking shit. And he left the room. I wish I could see that footage. Yeah, Parfrey was a little bitch.
You were in Chicago. Did you know Peter Sotos?
Yeah. Peter was a little bitch too. I'm sorry if you're fans of these guys, but Peter was a little crybaby too. He made me.
That's fine.
If you look at my printing of Answer Me Number 4, I think it was 4, the rape issue. I reprinted that while Goad was in prison to help him. We were friends and I helped him raise money while he was in prison. I sent him money. I was like, you know, he's like, I'll give you the reprinting of my book. I'll let you have that book. And I'm like, you don't have to do that, Jim. I'll help you out. I'll figure it out. And he did. So I did reprint it in a box set and all that. And Peter's like, you got to take my name off the book because you're publishing it. So you'll see Peter's name is stricken from that book. Peter came to that Expo the Extreme the time I had the first black metal band in the States, and he was trying to get in for free. And I don't let anyone into my events for free. So I was like, yeah, no way. And he was upset about that. But then he was like upset because he was offering me books to publish before that. And I'm like, no way, dude, I'm not publishing your books, because around Chicago, he was understood to be a real pedophile. And he wasn't experimenting in with what his artwork is an expression of who he is. He wasn't experiencing, it wasn't transgressive.
How did he present himself? Was he presenting himself just that way? Or I haven't actually read him, but where was he presenting himself that it was like avant-garde art?
Well, again, it was pre-internet. So we understood this in an underground way, in a counterculture way. And because police had arrested him a few times and found materials in his house, and he claimed it was artwork, but people understood him as this. They because you know, you're in a community, believe it or not, you're going to talk. And he was a bartender at Second City, this comedy club in Chicago that, like John Belushi, it raised some of the best comedians in the day. And so he was just a bartender there, and you go hang out and have drinks with him. And Peter was friendly with me until I didn't want to publish him. And back in the day, I was like the cooler underground publisher. I was cooler than Parfrey and stuff like that. So these they're basically, I don't know about.
Oh, so you had your own publishing company.
Yeah, Michael Hunt Publishing. So I was publishing Mike Diana for being obscene, and everyone came to me for publishing. And so people would ask me to publish him, and I would tell them no often, because I was real selective about what I did. I'm coming out of a Chevette. I'm living, I'm coming from plumber stock. And so Parfrey and other people, they had this pretense and education that they were able to get distribution. They were able to figure out how to do things that I couldn't. And my stuff was too hard though. Like in that day, obscenity mattered. And so
were there still obscenity laws? Because
oh, yeah.
Like, it's right now, I think the big issue is like people on the right are talking about woke cancel culture, but I think there were actually still obscenity laws even in the George Bush era.
Oh yeah, man. There were. Well, I was publishing someone who was brought to trial for obscenity laws. He went to jail for cartoons, for drawings, and so yeah, that happened, and we had consequence all the time because of what we were publishing. I was run out of towns. I've been run out of towns. I mean, we had hard consequences, and it's funny when the internet came along. I was like, I'm out of. I remember Parfrey's like, "Don't get on the internet." I'm like, "Dude, you're just not going anywhere. You might as well get on there." So I was.
So
one
cancel
of the first-
culture is not. It's a big problem, but it's not. It's far from being a new thing.
Yeah, cancel culture is a real. It is a different thing because it's so everything is online, and so you really are affected. I've been canceled 16 times now.
I think back then. Because there wasn't internet, like people didn't really know about it or think about it.
Right, you could go get a job, and no one's running your name on the internet, seeing, oh, you're called a Nazi, you're called this, you're called that. So it was a different thing. Now, like when I was run out of town, I was run out of this small Minnesota town. It was when the internet was first popping, and some of the people were friendly with me, but it was intense because you know death. I was getting death threats every day when I was a publisher back then, every day. And I would always welcome, give them my address, say, come on by. I'm going to leave the back door open because I've always wanted to kill someone in at that time. And I said, if you come in my house, I can kill you legally. So please do come by. And so, but it got to be too much. I'm in this small town. And I remember saying, well, how could you put this stuff on the internet? And I'm like, do you not realize the concept of the internet? Like your children are going to have the same problem I'm having now. Basically, I'm saying your children are going to be canceled. I didn't understand. We didn't have cancel culture there. But I'm like, you know, your children are going to say something when they get out of high school or their early years in college that is not going to sit well with the general public. But it's going to be online and it's going to be used against them. You're creating a bad situation by fucking with me based on my expression or my businesses. Like, I'm like, you have South Park pumped into this small town. Are you kidding me? I wish I could be as offensive as South Park, you know, but. Yeah, it was something, but the internet has weaponized things, like you would say, to a degree that has taken me to my knees a couple times, dropped me to my knees. And so, like, I've been harassed by this group called Queer Satanic, where they put out this stuff, and they clip these small clips from this 24-hour radio show. It was the first 24-hour streaming broadcast on the internet. And we had Nazis on there, we had Satanists on there, we had every offensive thing on there. It was great. And we said some offensive things on there. And I was like coming from a free speech point of view. Like, I'm like, I'm going to say these words because now we don't have to ask the newspaper guy to run an article on us. We don't have to be on a TV station. We don't have to hope the DJ will do an article about or do a show on our books. We can say whatever we want. So I was saying these really outrageous things, and they clipped these 24-hour show, one day of my life. They clipped these words that I would say, like the N-word or whatever. And they had weaponized it to the point that it caused me great trauma and great problems with people all over the place. And it caused me problems because I don't subscribe to a racial belief like that. So if people at times will say, you know, like I've backtracked on that. I'm like, no, I've never been that. Okay. If I were that, I would have no problem saying anything I felt any time of day. And that's the kind of person I've always been. So now I've been labeled as someone like as a weak person. I won't talk about my politics or I'm racist, and I've never been that. And so it really bothered me for a long time. And I relate to you guys when I saw you canceled, and especially Francis. I've seen him a lot I've been friendly with him on Twitter for years. And I'll see people treat him in a way where I'm like, why are they doing that? Why did they do that to you? And he's like, he sends a link, and I'm like, yeah, it's just like words. It's what's going on?
I mean, it's a long story. I mean, but I like the connections that you're making. Like, because I remember meeting Lydia Lunch back in 2019.
Hate her.
Well, I talked to her about Goad and Sotos, and she has some pretty interesting stories that I saw a different face of, and some with Michael Girard of Swans, but we had a little, you know, hang out for an hour, but a lot of those revelations kind of goes back in the circle, you know. In fact, when you're speaking of Parfrey, you know, we got to talk to him before he passed away. But
Francis, you hosted that episode.
Yeah, with J.G. Michaels and
J.G. Michaels, what a little bitch too.
Wait, what happened to Michaels?
I'm curious how you know him, because I met him I met him through like a Facebook group.
Yeah. I was
in the 2010s, and he used to host a few shows I did.
Well, I was the king of the underground, so people are in the know, and he was in the know, and he's been following me for like a decade, and he did some interviews with his radio show, but he's just like this little anarchist bitch, and I don't like how that turned out. Like he
mm-hmm. Well, going back on topic,
I remember
when I made a tribute video about Adam Parfrey and tried to say nice words, his sister Julia called me a robot for some odd reason. I'm like, well, what are you doing? I think Parfrey did a lot. And it's like, no, you're saying all this wrong stuff about Parfrey, even though Parfrey was putting up, you know, serial killer lore and all this and that. You can't just judge him and it was really convoluted, kind of strange.
I heard this story from J.G. Michaels. It's funny.
Interesting. The Juliet Parfrey thing. So I don't exactly know what the Parfrey's issue is, but it does remind me of another individual, Margot Metroland, who also writes for Countercurrents, who was very close with Parfrey. But, you kind of go back to those connections and it's kind of one big circle we talk about, and it kind of goes back, and it seems like it's just one big dysfunctional family all talking about avant-garde hate and and goes to Chuck Palahniuk in Fight Club, and then Chuck Palahniuk like, I love Jim Goad, and I'm like, wait, what? So it's like a deep, it's like I'm trying to put the school of Athens, but it's the school of Midwest transgressive artists that equally hate each other.
Well, did Lydia Lunch say she doesn't like Jim Goad?
No, she likes him.
Right, okay, because she gave him a forum to talk shit about me at one time, and I was like,
"Oh,
that really is like a great thing when people slander my name and then not come to me for any answers, like, or talk to me about it." So that I really don't like her after that.
I just find it fascinating. She likes Jim Goad, but ignores the white nationalist intentions, making me think she is a white nationalist. You know?
Yeah,
I thought that was peculiar. And another connection, too, I always thought was fascinating. We actually had Anesh of Chyme FDM on the show. I think, like, yeah, G.G. Michaels was on that as well. And they were based in Chicago for a bit. I mean, Sasha now is in Sasha's now in Hamburg. But they were in Chicago for a long time, and Anesh doesn't talk to Sasha. And they have Ray Watts and Gunter Schultz with Pig. But
I've met him before in Chicago when I was a kid at Pig Face shows and all that stuff. Were the greatest time you could ever imagine, man. It was the greatest thing to see that Wax Trax scene from the ground up. It was just one of the most magical things I've ever seen. And,
yeah,
and
I love Wax Trax.
Yeah, to go to shows and they're sucking each other's dick on stage and stuff is like something you, as a young man, maybe in my 20s, I've never seen anything like that. It was just really great.
I mean, Raymond Watts, he's definitely subtly, he knows about White House and Peter Sotos, but he doesn't really, you know, now he's hanging out with Sasha Gray, who named herself after Sasha Konietzko of Chyme FDM. So there is that kind of weird Wax Trax celebration of sorts. But yeah.
Is Sasha Gray the porn star?
Yeah, she hangs there with Ray Watts of old ex-Chyme FDM. And
absolutely in love with her.
Yeah, so I'm just saying you have that little circle right now of... if Pig's on tour, then Sasha Gray comes along.
Then wasn't Boyd Rice in Death and June?
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
I mean, it goes back. I mean, another
Boyd Rice was in, I think, Richard Wollstonecraft's.
Yeah.
Forget the name of that movie.
Pearls Before Swine.
Pearls Before Swine, right?
And Pierce and Boyd Rice and
all these people I hate. Boyd Rice.
Yeah, that scene, I wrote an article called The Origins of Industrial Music, and I said there was
I've never interacted with Boyd Rice because he doesn't have like an online presence, but I have interviewed, I know Wollstonecraft, and mm-hmm. he got my movie Supply that I made with Matt Pegas got an award with his Melbourne Underground Film Festival.
So you two are part of the new transgressive culture. Is that it? Or you're part of a counter? You're part of the counterculture.
Yeah.
Nice.
Or do these try to study it and see where it is in the post Silver Age and make sense of all the dysfunctionality going on?
Yeah, you asked a question in your thing about what is the purpose of underground art with these transgression implications, and I wrote an answer if you want to hear it. And I don't ever take notes for interviews. Never. I never do. So I took your stuff very seriously. And I felt like you were part of our family. And so, like, the counterculture family. And so White Panthers and all these hippies would give me, you know, give me the baton. And it's like, so working with younger people feels very similar to what they were doing with me.
It's been a really excellent show. So great to meet you. Really interesting subject matter. Before I wrap up, Shane, do you have anything else you'd like to add, or anything that you'd like, any like projects that you've like to plug? It's really been great speaking with you.
Nice. Well, I'm going to read this then that I was talking about. What is the purpose of underground? There is no purpose of underground art outside of expression. It is underground because it comes from the poor folks. It becomes mainstream when rich folks culture vulture it. Transgression is slightly different only because its expression is revenge, giving back the pain society has thrust upon the transgressive artist. You could say that transgressive art movement is the chaos magic of today. So there's what I had written down for you.
And Pillater, the culture vultures, that's what you mean when you say like the blowjob kings.
Wait, and that's what you say. Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, technically speaking, I might have mumbled the word a year ago.
I'm pretty sure you coined it.
But I wasn't aware of it. And then you popularized it. And I was just mumbling under my voice and then you rode with it or something. But no,
the archetype is someone who's very good at like promotion and getting someone like, who has like,
right.
It's more it's about like getting subscribers and promotion.
Mm-hmm. The grifter, kind of the ideal of somebody who puts a model, a face, YouTube personality, and says they're all this, and then they're not authentic. They only care about a parasocial relationship using you. They talk about culture war. It's not. And you're seeing that a lot right now on the internet, especially how easy politics is today. The next minute I'm left, the next minute I'm right. Then you feel like it must mean lemmings going off a cliff. So I think it's this whole historical erasure that's happening and people are not connecting the dots. So I think we should be skeptical of everything and all possibilities because people have become more closed-minded today than
nothing is true and everything is permitted.
I love that phrase. If that's the case, then you can do anything you want. And
that's right.
You are as the good news, but
you asked if I had anything to add. Just I have a book out called Inside the Satanic Temple, you know, their secrets revealed. So people should check that out.
And that's out now or that's upcoming?
Yeah, it's out now. It's on Amazon, ebook and a regular book, and I'm quite proud of it. So
Shane Bugby, great speaking with you, great show. Thanks for being on, and also thanks Francis.
Thank you both.
Thanks very much.
Peace.